So, of course, this is a class on death and dying as a spiritual journey. And in a minute, I'm going to ask each of you to just tell me, and particularly because we're such a small group today, what you hope to hear here or find here, or even if you don't know, just what drew you, whatever that was, because we can really tailor the class. I think all of you have heard me speak. And although I always jot a few pages of notes, they sit here on the music stand. And I rarely, I think Ellen particularly knows, she just because she's been to many more of my classes, but I rarely look at them. I always say this is my somehow my security blanket. I think the masters come right through this music stand to me. But it's very easy to tailor a class. And I have found, I keep saying that I'm going to start offering a class once a month or once every 2 months. This is just questions and answers because it's such a nice way to dive deep into any spiritual teachings. But Stephen, just responding to what you said about having been blessed here once by Swami Kriyananda, and I don't know, Krissa, what you know or don't know about Ananda, and it doesn't matter, the class today is not about Ananda at all. And in fact, the teachings in Ananda, what Yogananda came to this country in the early 1920s to teach, was what is called Sanatana Dharma, which means eternal truth, which is why Jesus is on our altar. And Swami Kriyananda asked him once, was Moses a true avatar? And he said, oh, absolutely. He had the serpent go up his spine, I mean, which is energy going up our astral spine. So, you know, we're talking about those truths that underlie all great religions. And that really is what Ananda is. It's not a religion per se, though mostly we talk about the teachings from the Gita and the Bible. Swami Kriyananda has analyzed many of the other great spiritual teachings or written commentaries on them, I should say. Not analyzed is not accurate. The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam and many things, really, because they're all saying the same thing. So Swami Kriyananda was a direct disciple of Yogananda. It means he actually lived with him while he was the last few years of his life. He died now, I think it's coming up on 3 years, 2 years, is it just 2 years? In April, 2 years ago that he died. But he founded everything Ananda. So not just all of what we see, all of the teachings, all of the music, all of the books, but this is a real, probably the largest intentional spiritual community in the world. So it's extraordinary what he did. I mean, 450 pieces of music, 150 books, and things that mostly people don't do. It's interesting, I'm going to come back to, I have one little comment I want to make about your blessing, but I'm just reading again, I've read it before, but I pick it up, a book that's called something like Conversations with Great Composers. I don't know if that's exactly the title, but it's a book that's been written from interviews that a man did in the late 1900s, primarily with Brahms, but many other composers are quoted in there. But he sat with Brahms and did several days of interviews, and at the end of all of it, Brahms said, you can't publish a word of this till 50 years after I die. And it's published now, of course. It was published in like the 1950s or something. It's very compelling reading. But the thing that got me is listening to Brahms, who speaks about pure inspiration and what that means and how that's the way he composed and how he would have to sit and pray and attune himself to a divine presence, which is his word, and only then would the music come. And he said, and then it would just come. He said there was no writing it. And he said, when you listen to music that's been written by somebody, he said, you can immediately hear the difference. He said, but inspired music, and apparently Beethoven was apparently notorious for this, and when people would complain about some of the fingering that they had to do on the violin or on a piano with Beethoven's music, he would just scream at them, literally scream, when I'm writing this music, I am hearing it from God Almighty. Do you think I care about what problems your hands are going to have? I mean, really, So this type of prolific, inspired writing slash truth that comes through really speaks to the greatness of a soul. That's just all. You know, it's not somebody's opinion that's being written. It's truth. It's inspired. It's being heard. And there's just no way, as you know, most of us, if we publish a couple of books in a life, that's a big deal. People write a few pieces of music, or 20 or 30, that's a big deal. But what Swami Kriyananda did is, it just feels nearly, you could describe it, like being humanly impossible. There's one of the lines in the Bhagavad Gita that says, even a moment in the company of a true saint can be your raft over oceans of delusion. Meaning, just to be in the company of a saint for a moment can mean things that really with our human minds we simply can't comprehend. So it's no small thing to have been blessed by him. And obviously you felt that. But he was a very great soul. Of his own admission, not an avatar. He was not born as Jesus was, or Yogananda, or Moses, or Buddha, because we needed them to come here because of the times or the trouble, like the amount of trouble that the Jews were having when Jesus appeared. You know, they were a very devoted people who then got lost. You know, they had their rabbis become their kings and became very materialistic. They got confused. They had 600 and some laws that they had to live by every day, and they forgot to sort of move through their heart a little bit. And so Jesus appeared, you know, basically to say to them, you're in trouble. I'm here to remind you of what the truth is. But anyway, they had a little trouble understanding him at the time. So I say we because I was born and raised Jewish, which has, I wouldn't say little to do with my life. I think it has an enormous amount to do with my life. But I'm not a practicing Jew anymore, which I was for many, many years. But I will still say we, because anybody who sees me from about a mile away knows I'm Jewish. I have so much of the culture in me. Are still waiting for the Messiah at Passover. And this year I found it very interesting that the first night of Passover and Good Friday were on the same night. And I wanted to just yell out there to the Jews, watch for the whole rest of the weekend. Don't miss this story. But anyway, everybody here's in their own good time. So this is really rather a remarkable class to give. And I will say, did you take our death and dying class before, Ellen?
I took a series of classes. A series? Talked about.
Yeah. Asha and I have done it together as an 8-week series. I've done it many times as a 4-week because, like so many things in our spiritual teachings, the whole of one's spiritual journey is contained in the teachings. So to talk about death and dying, and then I added in the title as a spiritual journey because I wanted people to come who were clear that that's what we would be talking about. There's so much about, well, the whole class will eventually, no matter what anybody thinks they came here for, you will see, we will make it about our spiritual paths, because that's really, you cannot speak about death without speaking about life, and you can't speak about either of them without speaking about karma. So it just all winds out coming together. But before I move on, let me ask, I mean, you don't have to speak, but if you're willing to, it would be lovely to hear what drew you here today. And since this is our mode of recording, I'm just going to hold it up and ask you to speak up. I'll repeat important things that you say, but if anybody cares to share, I would love to hear from you just what it is that drew you here.
Okay, I'll go. I came because I'm drawing up all the documents that you're supposed to have, you know, in case you need an advance directive and all of that. And, you know, it's a very technical document. Yes. And I took care of an aunt when she was dying, and so I thought about what I want for myself when that happens. If I'm if I know ahead of time that it's going to happen, what could I do now to prepare for that? Right. You know, I certainly don't want to be in a hospital with machines and all that kind of thing, but what can you do to prepare for that so you're in an environment that allows it to happen and just allows the process to go forward?
That's an amazing thing to think about.
And then who could I line up to support me in that?
Right.
But because I don't know that most people would be willing to do that. I don't know, you know. And so anyway, that's why I've come just to deepen how I feel about it and to see what ideas I can get for how I could maybe define that on paper. And if I had know anybody I could ask that would be able to help me, to ask.
That's wonderful. So let me just make a comment on that, then I'd like to hear from both of you if you want. And I'm not going to try and answer completely, but what I want to say, I'm going to repeat a little of what you said just for the sake of everyone who will listen after this class, that you're saying that you wanted to both prepare for your own passing in some ways and to think about what does that mean, because it's pretty much not on the papers that you're filling out. I mean, I've helped, I don't know if you both know that I'm a physician and that I had the third largest internal medicine practice in this country for many, many years. So I've practiced a lot of medicine. And in that capacity, plus now as a minister, but certainly more medically, have helped so many people fill out those forms. So that's one thing. And the other is, who can we count on as we're leaving to see to it that that environment is conducive to leaving in the way that we might want to leave whatever we hear here today that might help us decide what that is. And what I just wanted to say to you about that, although I will definitely speak to a lot of that, we have a leadership meeting every Tuesday morning. So the people who run East West, who run the community, run the church, the yoga center, obviously the leaders in all these various areas of Ananda, get together, we meditate for an hour, and then we have an hour of discussion. It's not really a business meeting. But it came up about 2 months ago in one of those meetings, very much in the way that you're asking about it, that we were all saying, now, of course, everybody who comes to those meetings is very much on a spiritual path. Most of us live in the community, or at least many of us do, not everybody there. And it matters a great deal to us. Oh, I know exactly why it came up. Because I have a very, very dear friend, I would say one of my best friends in the world, is right now dealing with a widely metastatic gallbladder cancer. It's a very bad cancer. She knows, in essence, it's not a curable disease. It's barely a treatable disease. So she was diagnosed and pretty much knows that within a year of that diagnosis, most people are gone. And I'm obviously very involved with her in many ways. But we were talking about the spiritual aspects of it in the meeting because people ask me about that a lot. It's a meaningful thing that's going on in my life right now. And it really came up that we are going to draft, and we are, I just reminded one of the women last week, a spiritual, if you will, version of the type of forms that we're all given to fill out. Do we want to be on life support? Do we want to donate parts of our body? I mean, those type of questions. If we can't breathe, do we want to be put on a respirator? If we can't eat, would we want to have a feeding tube? I don't know if any of you have filled out those forms yet, but these are specific questions that are asked. And I encourage every single one of my patients to fill them out, unless they're like less than 30. I don't talk about it. But anybody over 30, because, well, the number of times that I've seen people go unexpectedly, and none of that's filled out. And it is really very often painful for the people around you to have to make those decisions. But what I was saying is very much what you're talking about, and we'll talk about the why of this today. It's very important to me, if I linger at all, what that looks like. I have several friends in my life who talk all the time and incessantly, That is what they do. They're not meditators. They don't know how to listen. They always want to be doing things for you, and a lot of it's very verbal, and it's on you. It's like hard to say, shh, or can you be a little more inward, or because it's not anything that they really know about. It's not a practice for them. And I started saying, I want to have people around me so that these people who consider themselves to be my very best friends, somebody's going to be there to say, no speaking in the room. And Shanti wants a CD of Swami Kriyananda chanting Om playing as she goes. And she doesn't want to be touched a lot, or whatever it is. And I don't even believe that my partner, who I need to say all this to, who I've been with for 30 years, by the way, I call him my husband, though we've never formally gotten married, but I mean, we're just, our lives are completely wrapped up. I don't think he would have any idea how to do this. And he would be wanting to do what was best for me, but it wouldn't be. Because what is best for me is a vibrational knowing. It's not an intellectual understanding. It's not simply play this music or that. You can't say to somebody who doesn't meditate, I want people keeping all of their attention and energy at the point between the eyebrow when they are in a room with me if my soul is trying to leave this body. And again, we'll talk about all this. So I'm only saying that what you're asking is incredibly important, and we all decided that we wanted to fill out another form that would be like that, that myself and another woman are going to write, and then sit down with our families, not easy, our children, our siblings, in some cases our parents, and say, this is what I want, and this is who I put in charge of this. Because mostly they can't know if it matters. Now, to other people, this friend of mine who's, I mean, she's living, so it's an interesting thing to say, but she's dying. Yes. And I just told her the other day, she was staying at my house for just 10 days recently. She just left yesterday. But I said to her, I didn't expect you to live till the end of March. I said it in the context of this little throwaway oral chemotherapy that we gave it to her instead of saying, there's nothing else we can do for you. Her oncologist did it while I was in the room, but I thought, boy, that's so kind of him to say, let's just try this, because big guns chemo weren't working. The tumor was growing anyway. I said, we thought it was a throwaway. Sadie, I can tell you that now. You know, I thought you'd be gone by the end of March. But I said, look, it's actually helping you. But I had asked her once, about 2 months ago, who do you want around you when you die? Because, of course, she wants me there. And, you know, she has other people in her life who have nothing to do with this spiritual journey, some people in her life who are psychiatrically disabled and who would be very, the Sanskrit word is rajasic. It almost describes what it is by the word. But it's quite rambunctious and very loud. But nobody who's really close with her, her children, most of her other friends, most of them don't believe in anything. They haven't even given it any thought. And she has been on a spiritual path. So asking her that question, she said, well, of course I want my children. It doesn't matter to who they are. Other people would not feel that way. So it's a really, really meaningful thing to be thinking about. Okay, either of you?
I think that there's so much that Western society, that they all support it.
Yeah, that's it, a service once you're gone.
Yeah.
Right.
But what I, so I have some questions around death with dignity, because too.
You know, I just would point out, because we're talking about, I mean, what you're saying is wonderful. And I think people who have had quote unquote near death experiences, I'll share some stories with you as we go today. I'm sure they'll just come through. But I thought, why do we call it near death? Really, in essence, people die.
Yeah.
It's a death experience, and we come back from them. And I have not myself had that, but I have been present for so many of those. I want to speak to them in a bit. And it does typically, almost always, relieve somebody's fear of death because they've been outside of their body and they realize it is not what it looks like from this side at all. And really what most of us are so afraid of is that unknown. And if you've ever watched anybody die for reasons that most people do not understand, but I'll speak about it also as we speak about astral spine and energy and chakras, it can look pretty awful. You know, the body does not necessarily look pretty as it's dying. In fact, most people, the body will start contracting and doing things that are difficult to watch, although I've been around many deaths where somebody just closes their eyes and goes. But very quickly you become aware that that's a shell sitting there. And that's hard for the people who are left because they don't know anything about after this. Because as you said, most Westerners, and to be honest, a lot of Easterners, most people, I want to say, are extremely uncomfortable with death because to them, what you see is what you get. They believe this material world to be what there is. And let's face it, I mean, the whole system is set up so that it's pretty easy to get kind of lost here and believe in what we see, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We can say from both a Buddhist and a Hindu and even from Christ, would truly be Christian or Christ-like, Christ consciousness point of view, this world is nothing but a dream. Nothing that we see here is what it looks like. But as I say those words to anybody, what does that mean? That's meaningless because we're sitting here trying to understand that with the human mind. And it's just virtually impossible. Yogananda said this very beautifully. He gives many, many examples, but he said, you know, if you go to sleep and you have a dream, and you dream that you are a great general in the army, and you go out and you win a lot of battles and you save a lot of lives, and you feel so great about what's happening, and then you enter a battle and you get wounded, you get shot, and you're in a lot of pain, and you realize that you're going to die, and you get terrified, and you start thinking of everything that you're leaving and everyone that you're leaving, but you know you're dying, and you're horrified by it, and then you wake up, and you're so happy to realize, wow, that was all just a dream. I didn't win the battles, but I didn't lose the battles, and I'm not shot, and I wasn't dying. And he said, one of these days when you actually leave this body, you will see that what you're living right now is nothing more than a dream. And you will awaken to the truth, just as you awaken in the morning after dreams to the reality of this life. But in the dream, it all felt very real. And in that way, we can at least let our minds maybe a little more understand. But there aren't that many people reading these teachings. There aren't many comparatively practicing Buddhists, or in our case, we call ourselves self-realizationists, whatever it is. There aren't many of us. We're in the minority in the world. So most people are not thinking about death. Jewish people, certainly there is no teaching in Judaism. The teaching is you're here, you got it, you die, that's it. Well, I mean, it would be very horrifying to think about that being a complete and utter end. I mean, how do we even think about that? So we don't. Most of us don't. And I have seen hundreds, I mean, maybe more, but I don't want to exaggerate, of people in their late 70s and 80s who haven't yet written a will. They keep saying, I will. When do they think they're going to do that? You know, it's so remarkable to me. Or the number of people, and this is not hyperbole, these are true. Any story I tell you or right now as I'm just handing out a generalization, how many people I see in the course of even a week, so I do urgent care medicine at Kaiser, just a half a day or two half days a week, that's all the traditional medicine I'm doing anymore. But people who come in who are in their late 70s, late 80s, even early 90s, who are shocked absolutely shocked that they're sick or that they've developed high blood pressure. And they look at me, they say, but I've always been perfectly well. Why would I have this now? And you know, I most often do is go inside and I say to myself, Master, I say, these are my words, please help me figure out what to say to this person right now that will help them and how to say it so they can hear it. How could you be so shocked that at this time in your life anything's going to happen to this body? I mean, it's the substance of even so many jokes that the comedians do. And, you know, there's only two things we all have to do, right? Die and pay taxes. And it just, but people are so surprised, in such denial. And I'm sure working at CARA, for those of you who don't know, it's a place that was founded as a place where people can really come to grieve. And there's individual counseling. There's a lot of groups that are done there. And it's great work to be. I might have known at one point that you worked there, but I just feel so great. One of my very dearest friends in the world, she is now 86, but she spent so much of the middle of her life working at CARA. Because it's just great work, because people are really shocked by death all the time. Never mind that, of course, it is a huge loss. Doesn't matter how ready you are for it. If your husband dies in his 40s or 50s, or quite frankly, even in their 80s, it's a loss. We're not here to deny the pain of it on the human side or just what that can mean to people, but we're here to broaden our own perspectives on it. The whole issue of death with dignity, by which I think you're talking about really helping somebody die, administering a drug, or is that what you're referring to?
If someone is terminal.
Yeah, under certain circumstances.
Suffering unbearably, yeah. You know, their prognosis is 6 months or less, that they're given some kind of obituary.
Yeah.
Their choice, like Brittany Maynard, you know.
Right. This I'm going to leave till later to even look at that. But what I want to respond to in what you said already is that, let me think of how to say this, because I don't know you, and you may be this person, so I'm not casting any aspersions on anybody here, but I will speak for myself. The reason that coming onto this particular path, well, I mean, I was just drawn to this path the minute I found that I knew I could say a lot of words, you know, and I could tell you all the miracle stories, how Yogananda reached out and grabbed me, and there were nothing short of miracles that happened in my life through Yogananda, long before I had ever heard his name or knew who he was, and that this is my path. And he knew that, and he knew it was time, and I wound up here just not by accident. And I think for our spiritual paths, that's true for most of us. When we're ready, our teachers find us. But for me, part of the extraordinary blessing has been that Yogananda lived until the 1950s, and then Kriyananda, who lived with him for all those years at the end of his life, lived until 2 years ago, so that we are getting the interpretations of these teachings through an avatar. So if Buddha were alive and he could speak to you, and he could say to you, here's exactly what I meant by no harm to any living being, it may well be different than what you think, or than what many of the people that you're learning from think. I'm not saying everybody, but I can tell you that in many, many years as a practicing Jew and as a seeker, as a practicing Jew, insisting my family be Orthodox, listening to every great rabbi I could find, you know, really going through something that was called the College of Jewish Studies, I was serious about it. I was looking. What I realized one day, sitting in shul on Yom Kippur, which is a very holy day. It's the holiest day of the year for Jewish people. I was sitting there, and it came to me. You don't really believe almost any of what this rabbi is saying. You've never believed much of what he says. And what he is saying is not inspiring you. And I remember that word came to me because I probably had never used it in my life before. I was 20. I got up, I walked out of the synagogue. I've never been back in a synagogue. Now, other than for a couple of friends, kids, bar mitzvahs. I don't think I ever, until that time, subsequently, one or two, met a rabbi who I feel had had an experience with God. I don't think they'd ever had that. They were teaching me what they had studied, what they had learned, what they believed to be true. Still, all of that is left to their mind, their opinion. Jews are they're very intellectual people. And quite honestly, so are most Western Buddhists. And a lot of Western Buddhists are Jews. I mean that. You know, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Ram Dass. I mean, we can look. Ram Dass actually was not a Buddhist, but and many of those people, they are great spiritual teachers. I'm not denying their greatness. And I'm not saying that Jack Kornfield or Joseph Goldstein, and I spent so much time with both of them. They may have well had, you know, an experience of whatever we call that in this language. It's samadhi, but it's of really knowing the truth, not just understanding it with your mind. So the way that these teachings get interpreted for us sometimes leaves a lot to be desired. There are many, many, many Christians who come to Sunday service in Ananda who say, I never understood what Jesus was saying until I came here. They're not converting to anything. They're not leaving. Many of them go to two services on a Sunday. But it's because Yogananda has told us what Jesus meant by a lot of these teachings. So it's avatar to avatar. So the only thing I want to say is I don't always know that I fully get what doing harm to another living being means. Now that's not, I don't mean that about helping somebody die. I'm going to leave that out. But really about making people comfortable and sometimes making them very comfortable. And sometimes I've wondered if that extra morphine is what helps somebody pass, though that was not my intention. But there's a lot of area in there that I genuinely believe only very great, highly evolved souls can know. And that when those words that can be so confusing get left to our interpretation, we can get in the way intellectually. So they're complicated questions and they're big questions. But I even hope with that, like at the moment of death, what does it mean? Because there is so much that I have done in my own little life to help people die well. Not by active, you know, people call it suicide or mercy killing or all these words. Death with dignity is a nicer way of saying it, but that's not what I'm talking about. But I'm talking about what it means if we have the opportunity to be with a person like who you're describing, like where my friend's going to be very soon. And many, many people, my sister died that way, my mother died that way, I have two brothers who have had near-death experiences, both of them, and I was with them as that was going on, though they're both back in their bodies right now. I don't know how many hundreds of people I've been with when they die. I've said it in many of my talks, it's a karmic thing with me. Yeah, I was just meant to be there. I mean, on planes, in car accidents, walking down the street. You know, it's just somebody in our community last week walked in, called me on the phone. He lives right across from me in Nanda. Says, I don't feel well. I said, what's going on? He said, I have chest pain. I said, I'll be right over. But as he was on his way over, he decided to try and walk to meet me. And I find him on the ground just about 10 feet from my front door. I said, why are you on the ground? He said, I thought I was going to pass out. I said, we have to get you into my house. We get him in there. Of course, I called 911. Massive heart attack. But it's just, you know, it's a thing. I don't know. It's part of how God was going to use me in this life, which is how I went to medical school through Yogananda. And I was told to go to medical school. I was 32 years old. And I got into medical school. Stanford is where I went. But into many other medical schools, I think you've heard me tell this story, Ellen. I never graduated from college. I had no undergraduate degree. 3 weeks before graduation from Stanford Medical School, the Dean of Student Affairs calls me in and says, we have a problem. We can't find your undergraduate degree. I said, I don't have one. He said, that is absurd. Stanford would never accept anybody without a degree. So I was friends with him. I was much older than the other students, my husband and I. I'd become very good friends with him. I said, well, John, you do have a problem then because I'm graduating. But I said, look, you're in good company. I was accepted at Yale and Duke because under Yogananda's Encinitas Hermitage, in the middle of a run, I was told, go to medical school and you need to go to an Ivy League medical school. And I was in the middle of a long distance run. I went home. I said to my husband, guess what? I'm going to medical school. And it's got to be an Ivy League school. And he said to me without a beat's pause, great, what do we do? I was a nurse. I mean, this is a true story. So I want to just get back to what my point was about that, because I'm giving you a bit of background only so you know. I'm trying very hard to not just speak from my opinion today, but rather from things that I've heard through Yogananda somehow, because he's been my teacher, but also through him about Jesus and what I've come to understand about the difference between intellectual knowledge and true spiritual knowing, the experience. And that is, there are very few people who pass who have anybody near them who know what is going on, know the truth about what's happening, and who are very comfortable with it, and who can help that soul leave. And it may then, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't think of it. I mean, it's a regular old word. But it may push the need to even make that decision about death with dignity in that way a real question, because there's going to be death with dignity, and suddenly the pain is not so great. But it takes a spiritual knowing to be able to do that. Otherwise, the person sitting next to you is as afraid as you are, and it's painful. It is painful. However, that gets translated into physical, emotional experience and manifestation. And that's a lot of what we see. But if you have somebody who is right with you spiritually going through the experience, I think that soul that knows it needs to leave the body is having a very different experience. And that brings up another point, and that is, all we know so far is what it looks like to us. And what many of these experiences that you've had with your near-death experience, I remember when my sister was dying, she was 42, she called me, she said, I'm sick. And she had had a lung cancer. We had gone through a huge amount with her, and this was maybe a year later. And I said, how sick? I was out here. She was on the east. She said, I'm dying, and I'd like you to come and help me die. I was in the middle of my residency. I put it on hold, and I went and stayed with her while she died. That was the most extraordinary experience I've ever had with anybody who was leaving. But I'm telling you for a reason, because we'll share more as we go. I won't just keep talking. And maybe all of you have had those experiences, or maybe, Krista, you'll share yours with us. But I was so in tune with my sister that I felt like we were traveling somewhere. Like I was being given an experience of where she was going. And she knew it, and I knew it. Then she would say to me, but not in words, I want you to come with me. And I would say, no, Gwen, it's not my time to go there, but look how beautiful it is where you're going. And she would say, we'd be laying in this hospital bed together. And I was a doctor, and all the doctors knew I was a doctor. It was a scene. But she would say, I see it's beautiful, but I really don't want to go alone, Shanti. Just come with me. Just like that, she would say. And I would say to her, no, sweetie, I can't. But my mother came into the room, and she said, I just made a rule. Nobody's allowed to come in here and see Gwen or talk to her but you. I mean, everybody was there. She was a 42-year-old woman. I said, why, Mom? She said, she's only relaxed when you're with her. She gets agitated when any of the rest of us are with her. So I said, how about if I come out and I talk to everybody about how to be with her so that she can stay more calm? And I told them, She's in a very delicate space right now. Don't speak to her. It doesn't sound like normal talking. It's like a crude energy to her. Don't touch her. Think what you want to send her. Tell her you love her in your mind. If you want to give her a hug, give her a virtual hug. I didn't use the word because the word wasn't around those days. But, and I told them all this. I said, come in, be quiet, broadcast your love, is what I told them. And she never got agitated after that. So I think, and so many more stories, again, so many, that what the soul is actually experiencing is not what we think. So it maybe is not painful. It maybe is not suffering, even though everything from our side says, oh my God, they're writhing, they're groaning, they're... I don't think it's what we think. I've been around enough death that I just feel that. So it at least opens that door again. Not that you don't have the right to make our own choices, but I don't know that it's the only merciful thing to do. And I'm telling you, I really look at this because I'm around it all the time. And it matters to me. Suffering really matters to me. But death and dying as a spiritual journey takes on a whole other meaning. So, Stephen, did you want to say?
Sure. So I've had a number of connections with death recently. My dad died 20 years ago, but my mom just passed away about a year and a half ago. And so having both parents gone, that's been a sort of big thing. My uncle just passed away, and this coming Wednesday we're having a sort of celebration of his life. And then I was diagnosed about 2 years ago with a chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is, for many people, they don't die of it. It lasts for a long time. And for some people, they die quickly. And so it's very uncertain with how that's going. And so dealing with that health issue, fortunately, I've been physically pretty healthy. But there's that uncertainty about the future. And so grappling what that means and where I want to put my time and energy right now, all those kinds of questions have me thinking a lot about it. And so when I saw the announcement of this group, I said, oh, I should go to that.
That's wonderful. Good for you. I mean that, really good for you. One of the things I hope to be able to talk about, in fact, I'll make it a point now, is just how important and meaningful, really at all times in our life, but particularly, not that, as you said, people with CLL, they can die at 90 of something else, and many of them do. And those who die quickly usually do just that. But still, having said that, it was brought into your life for a reason, that you have to be looking at, whoa, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, big deal. And it's wonderful that you're asking the question, how do I want to spend the rest of my life? Whether, I don't know how old you are, or if you care to 55. So whether the rest of your life is 40 years, 30 or 40 years, or 3 or 4 months, you know, to ask that question, because to the soul, time is meaningless, interestingly. So, Ellen, we're talking a little bit, I don't know if you want to say anything, just about what drew us to this class, or if there's anything in particular. You know, just struck. I mean, I'm taken with everybody's story here. And I'm just going to, for one moment, just parenthetically say, I said to Stephen when he first walked in, because there were only 2 people registered, and I remembered there's this workshop going on at the farm, and there's a little cadre of people who always come to my classes, you know, and they're all over there. And so I said to David, the photographer, look, it could be 2 people, it could be 20, there's no way to know. But I learned a long time ago that the numbers don't matter, that the right people, meaning the people who are meant to hear what is said here for any reason, the people who are going to help, you know, really in a way allow that to flow through me as the teacher, they're always the right ones. And I have taught meditation classes to one person, and it's just been perfect. But as I hear you all speak, and I was really taken with your line about I had to become more grounded in spiritual teachings to be able to move forward with all of this, I just don't know how much all of you know. Maybe you all know this, but I mean, because there's no babies in this room. But being somebody who's out in the world sharing these teachings a lot, it's very unusual to even find four people that you can get together who know that these are the questions to be asking. You know, the truth is, we're in a certain age and time. Spirituality is beginning to open up a little, but just at the very beginning of these long cycles of times called yuga. I mean, all you have to do is read a newspaper once or listen to a news once to know. Very dark times. And it's quite impressive to be sitting here with the four of you who, why do these questions even come to us? It's remarkable. It speaks a lot to how evolved our souls are. That doesn't make us better than anybody. This is not the ego speaking. This is saying it takes a highly evolved soul to even want to know these answers or to be searching in here. So it really is quite a perfect class. And I think the questions that you're asking are very meaningful. And it won't matter what their beliefs are. It will matter what can come through you that's perfect for them. You heard me tell the story the other night. Helen's taking this four-week series that we just started on Wednesday night on how to pray so God will listen. And I shared a story about this very, I have a very, very dear friend. She's been my friend since I'm 5 years old. And she has a couple of children who I was there when they were born. Now they're in their 40s. But one of them has a couple kids, and I'm just so close with them. But they asked me to do a baby naming for their daughter. And the main rule was, you can't talk about God, we don't believe in God. And it's really, really hard for me to either marry people, you know, when I'm, and that comes to me, my friend's kids is how it mostly happens. They want me to marry them, they sort of love me, but they don't get that why they're loving me. It's not really about me, you know, but it's very complicated. But because Yogananda presented this way of talking about God as eight ways that divine energy manifests in the universe, love, joy, sound, light, peace, contentment. Anyway, I don't know what I'm leaving out, but there's eight of them. And the inspiration came to me that I could go and be at this baby naming and lead it and talk about these qualities manifesting in this baby and never mention God. So I'm saying it to you, Helen, to say, once the teachings are with you, then there's a lot of way, because what are the basic teachings? That's it. It's love, it's joy, it's inner peace, it's contentment. It's not knowing those things, it's becoming them. So if we ever are pure joy, then we are one with the divine. We are the divine, which we are anyway, which is what we're about to start talking about. But we've come into this world and we get drawn out. So instead of looking in, we're looking out. And Chris, I'm just going to say, for whatever it's worth, and I have no idea, Stephen, where you are, the other people I sort of know a little better, but these teachings, the way I'm going to speak about it is Yogananda's language, but they're universal. They're not Buddha's language. Because Buddha came, each of these great avatars appeared on earth, because Buddha, of course, actually lived, as did Yogananda, as did Christ, Krishna, Moses. I mean, all of these true avatars. And of course, there's many, many other very highly evolved saints and beings. There's very few avatars, true avatars, who have worked through all of their karma, which is what we're going to talk about today, who take human form again, not because they have anything left they need to work on, if you will, for right now. I don't really like that phrase, but I'll use it. But any karma to neutralize, but more because we need them. So they are leaving a state of oneness with this superconscious, all-pervading, beneficent consciousness that we call God. People call it what they want. And they take human form to come here to be with us. And of course, they suffer in life and live through a lot of what we live through. And those are all good lessons for us because they look like human beings to us, so we can learn from them. But when Buddha came, people needed one set of lessons. You know, they were so dependent on God that Buddha had to try and say, find his way to say, look within. It's within you. Don't look outside. And I think a lot of Buddhist teachers, not all of them by any means, have taken that to mean that Buddha didn't believe in God, but that's not at all the truth. Just like so many Christians and Catholics have become completely confused about what Christ came to say. And so many Jewish people couldn't even tell you what Moses was saying or what does it mean? He went up on the mountain. What do those words mean? And he communed with the divine. It means he went into his third eye. He had an experience of samadhi. He found the truth for the Jewish people, and he came back down, and he came back out into the world and tried to tell them. Doesn't really mean he literally climbed a mountain, but I'm only saying this to you to say, if you can move beyond the words, this has been my path for so many years. Of course, I'm going to be speaking the way Yogananda spoke, but it's a universal language. That's what Sanatan Dharma means. And if Yogananda and Buddha and Christ could all be here, and Krishna, they wouldn't be having an argument with what they were all saying. They would know they're all saying the same thing, but we as human beings do. So I just wanted to say that because I think, again, without knowing, and it doesn't matter to me, you all came to Ananda to hear this talk, but is that I feel certain in an intuitive way that there's nothing that I would say today that any great spiritual teacher would disagree with. So I just wanted to put that out there. Before we can talk about death, before we can understand what that means, we really have to talk about what is life. Why are we here at all? Otherwise, how would we begin to understand this process of leaving? Because if we try and speak about death from the perspective of the human experience, which is ego-centered. And I don't mean that like egoic and arrogant. I mean it like it really is. For a body to be, for birth to happen, when that sperm and ovum unite, some soul, and I've heard Asha say this so much, I want to say, I've often thought of it, I've created an image of the divine that is everything in the universe, every ounce of energy that ever was or ever will be. And I've often thought of putting little sparklies on our fingers, like trillions of them, and we go like that, and all those sparkles come out, and it makes the trees and the rocks and the streams and human beings and all the animals and all the plants, but it's still a part of that whole. And that's how the only way I've been able to send it out as an image, because we're here and we're communicating through the mind. And unless we just decided to meditate for 3 hours, that's how we're going to do it. But I do want to say that Yogananda said, every atom in creation is dowered or filled with individuality. Every atom in creation, which means that as everything is made manifest, it is an individual part of the divine. That individual aspect that comes into this joins the egg and sperm, and at that moment we have life, is called a jiva. That's, I would use the word soul a lot, but as and soul is right. But what jiva does, there it's a Sanskrit word, and there's no English word for it, but it adds the element of allowing us to know and remember that we are individuals. And as we go from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime, it's that jiva, that part of the infinite soul that's moving and expanding and being drawn ever increasingly back into a state of oneness. So it's not as if when we die and our soul goes wherever it goes, which is not immediately for most of us, won't be, probably. I mean, I don't really know about anybody else's karma here. I don't exactly feel like I'm going to finish all of the work that I have to do from a spiritual level to for my soul to really remember its true nature. I'm working hard at it. I mean, I am. I'm on a spiritual path. I live in spiritual community. I teach. I come to classes. I give sermons. I listen to sermons. I come to kirtan. As much of my life as possible, I have around, I mean, I meditate every day around either spiritual teachings or other spiritual beings. I'm making as much of an effort as I can make now. But there are many times where I say to myself, pretty mediocre what you're doing, Shanti. Pretty mediocre. You know, you could bring a little more concentration to your meditations. You could add a little time. You could, many things I know I could do. And this is not about me, and I don't need to share it all, though I have no secrets. But there are ways I know I could be doing it even a little better. And just where I am and what I'm able to do, I'm doing the best I can do in the moment. So I don't spend a lot of time beating myself up about it. I just keep trying, and I'm not about to sit here and call myself a sinner, that's for sure, which Yogananda said is the worst sin you can commit, because we're in all an aspect of the divine, and it's like calling God a sinner. But I can see I have more work to do, is all I'm saying. But I think, I don't feel like when I leave this body that I don't need to come back again. As the way that I understand that things happen, I will be in another human body at some point, or some body doing something in some, I don't even know if it'll be on Earth, who knows where it'll be, but somewhere, so that my soul has this opportunity, that jiva, to work its way back to that state of remembering, of knowing without a doubt, you know, like Socrates said, to know something is to be that. Or that, again, there's a Sanskrit word for that memory. It's called smriti. It's not remembering with the mind. It's soul remembrance. Ah, this is home. This is where I belong. This is what I really am. And then there's not even an I to talk about it, because the I gets lost. Now, it's not bad that we're in this state, because we know, we've been taught, that the ego, which is that soul, that jiva, identified with the body, as soon as it becomes identified with the body, it needs an ego. We couldn't live without it. But the other interesting thing that happens is that from the moment we're born in this life, all because we have an ego immediately, instantaneously. You know, it is true that when the sperm and the ovum unite, the first part of the body that's made is the medulla. That instant, that's the first cells. And that really is the soul inhabiting that body. And then from there, the whole nervous system comes, then the cardiac system comes. I mean, there's a way we know this, of course, because people have lost fetuses and embryos and everything, how the body develops. That we become identified with ourselves, with this body. And the absolute nature of the human condition is to look out. We start looking outside of ourselves instantly. We need somebody else to feed us. It's the part of the human condition. We need somebody else to keep us warm and dry. We become dependent on things outside of us. Interestingly, animals don't do that for as long, but they too. I mean, every creature that we know. And we start noticing. A friend of mine talked about an experience that he had on a plane once when he was feeling particularly tired, and he prayed to God as he got on the plane, man who did a lot of traveling. Oh, Divine Mother, you're putting me on all these planes to travel. He traveled to teach these teachings. He said, Let me just feel you on this plane today. Let me really just, I want to know that I'm speaking to you and you're here. He said in the row right behind him, this couple sits down with what he thought was a brand new baby. He said he didn't think the baby was more than a couple weeks old. And it cried from the instant it got on the plane. And he had this experience, which was amazing to me, that he said because the baby was so new, he felt that the baby was screaming because it had just been separated from its divine mother. And he said he wanted to get up and go back and say to the baby, he said, but I knew the parents wouldn't be too happy with me, keep screaming. Keep screaming in whatever way you can to find your way back to God. He said he wanted to say to the baby, these are all his words, they're going to dangle all these bright, shiny, pretty objects in front of you. They're going to make you want to reach out and have those. They're going to want you to be satisfied with the things they give you. Don't listen to a word of it. You keep screaming. And he felt that, and he felt that's how God came to him on that flight. And it was so brilliant when I heard him tell that in a talk. It was many years ago now, but it's always stayed with me. He told it in a much longer form, but I didn't want to take the time today. But it really struck me because it is what all of our lives are about. It's all these wonderful little shiny dangling things, and it might be different for each of us, but whatever it is, it draws us. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with wanting a great relationship. There's nothing wrong with wanting your kids to go to the right universities. There's nothing wrong with wanting to have a nice house or pretty clothes or a couple of pairs of shoes. Nothing wrong with, or good health for that matter. Except when we think that that's what this life is about, that that's the goal of life, which, let's face it, most people in the universe do. Most people think that they are going to find their way to happiness, to peace, to enjoyment, to safety outside of themselves. There's that remarkable story of the man who lived through World War I in Europe. I mean, this is a true story. And when the war was over, and I mean, of course, Europe was ravaged, World War I, he decided that he was going to make himself safe. He said, I'm never going to leave myself vulnerable in that way again. And he went and he bought a piece of property on, now I'm forgetting the name of the island, very famous island that was one of the first islands to be bombed in World War II. You know, and it's, I wish I could remember the name of the island right now because it's so famous, it makes the story even more poignant, but that's what happened to him. You know, Asha told a story some time ago about a woman. One of the, you know, we have a school affiliated with Ananda called Living Wisdom School. They're actually all over this country. They're in Europe now, based on an educational system that Swami Kriyananda developed called, that is really ridiculous. It'll come to me in a minute. Education for Life. That's the name of the system, Education for Life. The schools are called Living Wisdom Schools. And it turns out now these kids do extremely well when they leave. They're usually in the top 5%. But years ago, we didn't know how it was all going to turn out. And the parents would come in, and they were horrified, particularly here and when we were first starting the school and in the Bay Area. But literally come in sobbing. They had this five-year-old, and they really believed in Living Wisdom School, and they wanted their kids to go here. But could we give them any guarantee that the kids would be able to get into a school like Harvard, they would say, or yeah. I mean, the kids were five. And one day, a woman, and you know, of course, our children are the most precious thing we have. I mean, it's not, I don't want to sound arrogant and make fun of them for checking out the school so carefully, but they would be very specific about what they needed. And one day, a woman came in and really just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed with, I think it was with Asha, if not, it was with the leaders of the school then. She helped the school get going, then pulled back. And it was not, I don't know, a year or two later, the woman developed a brain cancer and wound up dying, you know, which I'm sure had more of an impact on her child's life. We just have no, than worrying at age 6, 7, 8, you know, what university he was going to go to. We have no idea. We set these goals with so much energy that this is what we need to accomplish. And it's or what will bring us what we think we want in this life. That's why what you said, Stephen, touched me so deeply. For anybody to be saying, wait a minute, I just have this blinking yellow, if not, in your case, it's a blinking yellow light, but it's maybe blinking orange. I mean, it could be blinking red, and you know that, and I know that. And I mean, to say, okay, wow, now I'm looking at it. Or when you have a near death, how am I going to live the rest of this life? What do I want to do? Which is about getting spiritually centered and grounded on our own paths, whatever that is. But to have anything that comes to us that says, you know, I'm not so sure that what you see is what you get here, that this is the story. There is so much here to fool us. We're in a dream. But the dream feels so real that unless we put ourselves in exactly the position to be able to hear or know the truth, to remind ourselves. So you come on a gorgeous Saturday morning to a class so that you can hear, wait a minute, my ego's out here having this whole experience in life, telling me, find a good doctor, go to the best place to be treated. Okay, what am I going to do now? So I just had to say to my friend, you know, you were diagnosed in the beginning of September, 7 months ago. That's more life than we thought you were going to have. And you've spent a lot of time getting your life together, your house in order, your will in order, cleaning out the garage, doing this. And I said to her just 2 days ago, and she'll listen to these talks. I mean, she'll hear what I'm saying. She's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful soul. And I already told you, without a doubt, one of my dearest friends, and in part because we're both, she's not on this path, though she frequently will come to Sunday service here, but we share that. We share that spirituality has been the essence of our life. And I said to her the other day, you know, all these months, we haven't talked once about God or your soul or anything, like we haven't had, and she just started to cry. I mean, it was such, and I said to her, I haven't felt comfortable bringing it up to you, but you know, I've been wrestling with it. And she just started to cry, and she said two things to me that were very meaningful. She said, I want that from you, Shanti, and I need that from you. But not only have I not known how to ask for it, I haven't known what to ask for. I've been confused. We were both so relieved that I brought it up. But then she said, because I didn't want to impose it on her. It looked to me like what she cared more about was getting the garage cleaned out so our kids didn't have to do it. And she said to me many times, I don't want to leave my kids with a mess. But I said to her, we're not even spending 10 minutes a day meditating. And she said to me, you know, I pulled away from God at the beginning of all this. She said, in the last few weeks, I'm feeling that presence back in my life. And I said to her, I'm certain that's why I knew that I could speak to you now, just intuitively, you know. But boy, if not now, when? And we can all say, we have no idea when we're going to go. So, yes, it's very likely your parents will die before you, and it's very likely that Sadie will die before me, but I'm not sure of that. You know, I could be the one having that heart attack right in front of you guys, or get killed in an accident on the way home, or die in my sleep tonight. I mean, who knows? We don't know. And it matters so much where we are spiritually when we pass. It really matters that we, I always say to people, you know, my private practice now at medicine is a practice that's called transformational medicine. And it is there to help people transform, energetically transform, whether they have a medical problem, an emotional problem, a spiritual problem, or I deal with a lot of addicts and alcoholics who want to be in recovery. I don't care what the issue is, because I care about the fact that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but it can always be transformed. That's all I care about in this whole world, is the first law of thermodynamics, and that it's a physical law of the universe, it's the truth, and we all need to be living in terms of it. We all need to be looking at what is our personal transformation, what is the next step on the way there. That's all we can do is take our next step. But very often, when I write prescriptions for people in that practice, now this is not the urgent care at Kaiser, this is my private practice, I talk to people. And I listen to people really a lot, but I talk to. I write them prescriptions, and I write them for things, it depends. It might be you have to go over to the ocean, the prescription might be, go to the ocean twice a week, spend 2 hours there, and come home. It might be go up on Skyline with little easel and paints and paint. It might be go away with your partner one weekend every 2 months to Carmel or wherever you want to go. Get out of this life. It might be move your meditation from 10 minutes to 15 minutes. Whatever it feels like their next way of opening to something larger than what they're living right now. And I say to them, and particularly to the addicts and alcoholics who are working a program that's helping them stay clean and sober, do this like your life depends on it. Like your life depends on it, because it does. And that's true for us, because we're all here now. We didn't come here to say right now, gee, I used to be a painter until I had 3 kids and there was no time and I've never painted. And now I have chronic abdominal pain and nobody can figure it out. Guess what? You are in pain because you are not living your life. And they say, well, what are we going to do about my pain? Paint. No, but I mean, what about the pain? Paint. You know, because it's the next step towards finding our true nature. It's sometimes hard to believe what it is to get closer and closer to being true to ourselves. And it's not something that the last moment before we're just getting ready to die, people get very spiritual when they get sick. Very spiritual, all of a sudden. Now, if we're lucky, and I mean this, I mean it, I feel this way, and the illness lasts 2 years, all well and good. But if you're struck by a car and your soul's out of your body just like that, you know, and you've been, you know, whatever, stealing your grandmother's jewels to buy more meth, not such great karma. And if you haven't had a thought, a soulful, divinely inspired or focused thought in this whole life, you know, your soul really hasn't made much progress. It really hasn't. It's sort of, you know, what we're doing in this life is really not much more than what we do every night when we go home. We take off one set of clothes, we put them down, we get up the next day, we put on a brand new set of clothes, and we go out. And it's really hard for us to get, but life, one life, is not a whole lot more than that. Because the interesting truth about life and about death is that nothing happens. Nothing happens. We don't know that from here, because our egos are holding on so tight. They are really doing what they're supposed to do very well. It is the ego's nature. When I teach Med 1, you know, I tell people, we're made up of ego and id. What does the id say? I want what I want when I want it. That's part of the human condition. And the ego is sitting here saying, me, me, I, what about me? What's next for me? What's going to be? That's what it's here to do. And it's doing it very well. So you can't just say to your ego, leave me alone for 30 minutes, I want to meditate. No way. It's not its nature. It's not what it came to do. It's not what it's going to do. We have to find ways to give it something to do that will satisfy it, that will move us more in the direction that we want to go. So we give you a mantra to repeat. And we basically say to the ego, here you go. Say this over and over and over. Hung Sa, Hung Sa, I am that. I am the divine. I am the divine. Say it over, don't quit saying it. I am the divine. And we just give it things to do that are of a higher, more expansive, more uplifting. Uplifting, I'm doing this way because I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the astral spine and chakras, right? And moving towards the seat of Christ consciousness. It has nothing to do really with Jesus Christ, but Christ consciousness, the only begotten Son of God, not in physical form, right? This, moving us closer and closer to here, because the closer we are when we leave, the closer our soul is to its purpose, which is just finding its way back to that place of perfect joy, of perfect peace, of perfect contentment. So death takes on a different meaning when you begin to contemplate what is the purpose of life. Now, it's 11:30. How about if we take a 10-minute break? I promised myself that after Easter, I would start working on this form that we were talking about, but I didn't realize at that moment that just the week after Easter, we kicked off this prayer class I was teaching today, and I'm giving Sunday service tomorrow, so it filled up my week a little bit. But soon, I'm going to do it soon. I'm going to do it soon for the same reason that we're talking about everything we're talking about, and that is, you know, it's very important to me, this whole idea. It agitates me to think that I would be lying somewhere helpless, that I couldn't say what I wanted, and that some of the people in my life would come and just be too busy around me, because I have I'm not tolerant of that energy very well, even in life. My home is very Sattvic. You know, I'm busy. My life is really full, but it's like Yogananda said, actively calm and calmly active. It's a very different than this rajasic energy in the world. And I just have thought so many times, boy, that the idea that I'd be laying there and all this chatter would be going on, the thought of it drives me crazy. So anyway, soon I'm going to do that. And I think the hardest piece of that for most people is saying to people who love them, either I don't want you around me, or I'm leaving this other person in charge, or you know, however we need to say that. And I don't think there are many people in the whole world who even think of this, but you obviously thought of it. We've thought of it.
I don't want a lot around me.
Yeah. Well, I'll remember that, and if I know anything that's going on with you. But, you know, we did talk about someplace on this forum there will be a place to say, is there somebody? And, you know, you can list people. You know, it's like a will or anything. Who's going to do it? And if they're not around, who would be next? To be there to really guide these things. I know a few years ago, one of the people who's been a part of Ananda Palo Alto community for a long time, she's very central, she just precipitously got very ill and wound up in the hospital. And she came really close to dying. In fact, there was a miracle story even about that, because she was in a hospital, which I'll just let go unnamed, where I have no privileges. I don't have privileges at any hospital. I haven't for years now. And another one of our friends, we decided that somebody from Ananda had to be there with her at all times. I mean, we spoke to her children about it, because her children are not involved here. And we just said, you know, it feels really important to us to, and we think it would be important to her. I mean, she was so out of it. And they agreed that we could be there, but we were polite and we took a back seat. But whenever they weren't there, we would play this Om CD and do other things. Yeah, and then one morning at about 4 in the morning, the woman who was staying with her called me and said, she's really sick, she's got these high fevers, she's shaking. And I said, you know, she needs to have blood cultures drawn. And so this woman went out and said, well, there's no order for them. So I called the nursing station, and I said, this is Dr. Rubenstone, and I said, you know, this woman needs blood cultures. You really need to get aerobic and anaerobic, it means with oxygen, without all these, but you need to get 3 sets of these blood cultures right now. She said, okay, no problem. Drew the blood cultures. The next morning, I go in very early, 6, 7, and the doctor who's seeing her, who's responsible for her, comes in. It's a woman I went through medical school with. We never got along. And this woman was like, medical school was yesterday. What would I? So she was like, horrible with me. I didn't care. But I said to her, you know, I heard she had this thing, and I said, do you know if blood cultures were drawn? We don't need blood cultures. What good would blood cultures do? I said, gee, I don't know. I thought maybe fever and shaking chills. I mean, it was ridiculous. That's when you draw blood cultures, but anyway. But I had given the nurse the orders. I have no right to give orders there. But the nurse had drawn the blood cultures, and then it turns out on the blood cultures what was wrong with this woman is she had a fungus in her blood. And there is no way in the world, she was already on triple antibiotic coverage. None of that was touching her because it wasn't a bacteria. She would have died without those blood cultures. But you know, these masters just come and they just like part the Red Seas when it's time. I mean, these are the kind of experiences one has over and over and over. You know, getting into medical school without an undergraduate degree, giving orders where you shouldn't. You know, the story of what happened with my sister and other stories that, Christine, I'm really sorry to bother you. You know, where you start, you just start believing that we don't know anything. I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but it's just simply the truth. We don't know anything about what's going on here. Now, again, I'm not, these stories to me don't feel like they're not about me. That's always the danger in telling them. I feel I couldn't make these things happen for anything in the world. You know, it's not, that's not what happens. It's really what goes on in the universe that we know nothing about. It's what happens that lets us know. And after these things have happened 5, 10, 15, 20 times, you start saying to yourself, okay, I mean, this is all for me. I just think of it as these masters working through me. That's my blessing, right? The vehicle is blessed by that which flows through it. But I can't make it happen for all the money in the world. In fact, often when I try, I mess things up. The worst sermons I ever give or when I've gotten anxious about it the night before and I think I need to give the sermon. When I just get a few ideas and I sit and meditate all night and Sunday morning, the sermons are beautiful. It's not me. When I let myself get in the way, I can ruin anything and everything. And so I'm saying that to you to know, because the stories were given to me for a reason and they're compelling, but they're not coming at all from a place of arrogance. Does anybody have any questions or comments from the first half of the class so far before we move on? Anything you want to ask or share?
So going back to when I said I'd like to be more spiritually grounded to be able to handle and approach my parents.
Yes, and that's huge, right? I mean, no, and I'm saying it, and I'm saying it to you, even specifically, it takes enormous energy, willpower, devotion, commitment to continue on a what we're calling a spiritual path. Everybody's on a spiritual path. That's the misnomer of death and dying is a spiritual journey. Every single thing that happens to us, everything is a spiritual journey, everything. But you see, for us, and I'm going to talk about the chakras in a minute and tell you why, but to be putting ourselves in a position where we're continuously learning and having an opportunity to use every experience in life as a stepping stone on a spiritual path, right? Not as a stumbling block, but as a stepping stone. When I was a teenager, I bought a sign that I still have in my life. It's still on my bulletin board at home, that says the difference between a stumbling block and a stepping stone is how you use it. And it just struck me as a kid, and I bought it. But it's not easy to be here every Wednesday night to hear about a class or to come in on a gorgeous Saturday or to make it to a service or to be reading the right kinds of things, not exclusively. I'm not like that kind of strict in the world. I know most people are not going to do, most people aren't going to want the life I have. I get that. It's my life. It's my karma to live in spiritual community, to make choices about what kind of movies we watch or what kind of music we listen to or what kind of food we eat for that matter or who are our friends, what are we listening to all the time. Those, every bit of that, doing it consciously matters. So do I think it's bad? I met with a woman yesterday, 30-year-old woman, beautiful, just on this path maybe about a year, but really on this path. She's one of the people who just came, this was home, that's it. And I met with her yesterday for a little bit, and she was telling me that the people from, she works in some startup, they were meeting in the city and having a party. And she said to me, you know, I just didn't feel to go because they'll be playing, there'll be a lot of drinking and they'll be playing music and they'll be dancing and the conversations will just be really superficial. You'll never finish a sentence. And if you try and say anything important, they get uncomfortable and walk away. And I said to her, you know, just pay close attention. Make sure you're doing what you feel to do and not what you think you should do, because shoulds get people off of a spiritual path very early. So for a lovely 30-year-old, is it wrong for her to go out and dance with some friends? Of course not. It's not wrong. I mean, if she's not called to do that, great. But it's being conscious. It's not just having life do us. Now why, and that, so when you say just keep doing my own, it's huge. It's the entire difference between growing spiritually and not, between being a conscious being and not, between having any understanding of what it means to be drawing energy in and up rather than letting it go out and down. It matters. The music that plays in the background all the time. You know, my husband and I, we've been together 30 years. We've always had two homes. It's just a thing for me. I just knew I could not live with anybody. It has nothing to do with him. He's a perfectly lovely, wonderful man. I'm still with him. I adore him. I stay at his home, which is really our home, you know, three nights, sometimes four nights a week, but I have a home in the community. But no matter where we've been, we've always had two homes. One time, they were right next door to each other for a few years. But I always knew that I would need a place to go to. I mean, energetically, it's not personal. I could tell you now, because I've been with him for 30 years, what parts of it are personal. We are energetically so different. So I can say to you, he's a very bright man, and he's a psychotherapist, and he works really hard, and he has helped thousands of people. He's a brilliant psychotherapist. It's what he came in to do. I've referred people who are 14 to him, people who are 84, he helps them all. He's really, really good at it. And he's here at service every Sunday. I mean, he's not as involved on this path as I am, but he's certainly aware of it and involved in it a little bit. So this is not against him. But right now, he's into, and he loves music, loves all kinds of music, and he listens to music a lot. So there's often music playing. And it's not usually this music. And it's not usually what I would call inspired music. And he also is a car guy. He loves cars. And on his little iPad, he plays these car racing games sometimes. And they go, rum, 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 rum. And, you know, he could do 45 minutes of that. And now he's gotten into playing these, you know, flying these little, they're like little mini drones. I mean, they wouldn't hit you. They're a little game. But the, and I haven't even ever told him this yet. But the motor, it's constant. Constant. I can't be around that. That's not his fault. He's not doing anything bad. If I were to live in one house with him and be saying, please don't do this, please don't do that, please don't, when would he get to be who he is and do what he needs to do? I can't. I have meditated since I'm 27 years old. I'm 67 now. My meditation is a big practice. Meditation is about drawing energy up your spine, away from the lower chakras that grab your pelvis and do this with it, and up into your heart and into the throat chakra and into these chakras that are less away from the material, physical plane, and into that place that becomes progressively more of spirit, of oneness with the divine. Well, you do that for years and years, and it starts to work. And it's all energy, and all energy vibrates. And all this whole universe is, as we see it, everything is the same exact source of energy vibrating at different levels. That's all it is. It is that simple. The physicists are telling us now. The only reason you can sit on that chair, the only reason, is because you are not aware enough to be vibrating at its level. So it's vibrating at one level, making it look and seem solid to you. You're vibrating at a different level, making you look solid, but in a different way. This is how great saints can bilocate or walk through walls or walk on water, for that matter? How did these things happen? Because they have no experience of being separate from. They are a part of all of the energy in the world. Sometimes they forget they're in a body and their body falls. Yogananda said one time, sometimes I just forget which body I'm supposed to be keeping up because I'm aware, you know, he could tell you what was going on in Japan or anywhere. I mean, it didn't matter because they're everywhere. They're part of this cosmic consciousness. So my energy can't stand anymore. That lower chakra energy, that's what it is. And my husband rarely spends any time in my, I have a lovely townhouse in our community. I've been in it for many, many years. And he rarely spends any time there. And for a while, I was upset about it because we lived on opposite sides of the country for a long time. He moved, I tried living in Baltimore. That was a fiasco. He moved out here maybe about 7 years ago now. Now, for 23 years, he was always visiting me out here. He couldn't wait to get out here. One of us would fly every 6 weeks for at least a week, sometimes 10 days, in that little place. But since he's moved, I don't think he spent one night there. And I would yell at him, why am I always the one coming on? Blah, blah. But I have this dual life. Everything's set up in two houses. But then I realized, you know, it is no easier for him to be in my home where the energy is sattvic, calm, uplifting, heart-opening. Everything in that house brings you to here. Everything. If any of you walked into the house right now, you would feel it. People from all over Ananda come and stay in my house all the time. Everybody meditates there. People love being in that house. I keep it very neat because I like neatness when possible, because for me, it's like a spiritual quality. It's one part of not doing violence is to not be a mess. But it came to me that depending on where we are with our astral spine, our chakras, and I'm going to come back and explain that in a minute, other things feel horrible. So if I put on that Om CD for the wrong person when they're dying, that's going to make them as crazy as if my friends are sitting there chattering to me. Because where we are, and that's the vibration that we're drawn to, that we magnetize. It's no accident who we draw into our lives or the experiences that we draw, not because we thought, oh, gee, I want that, but because we are energy vibrating at a certain frequency. Energy has magnetism, and it draws. And there are no accidents ever, never. No illness, no death, no tsunami, no fire, no sitting out on your porch and having somebody drive by and shoot you, no medical problem, nothing. If we could always say, why is this happening in my life? We could learn from every single experience. Yogananda says there's no such thing in life as an obstacle. There are only opportunities. But what changes is how we see it. So to understand this really, we have to talk just a little bit about the chakras. Just a little bit. Now, in April, May, Connie Hernandez and I are teaching a four-week class on Wednesday nights about the chakras from 6 to 9. So it'll be 3 hours every Wednesday. It'll be a great class. We usually teach this eight Wednesdays. It's going to be hard. The chakras, every time you hear about them, you learn something new. They are subtle. They are esoteric, even on the spiritual path, if you will, because they're the most subtle form of energy. Because we're talking about vortices of energy that reside within us as part of what is called the astral spine. So the astral is the thought form of life. So if we think that there was a universal consciousness, one mass of energy that started thinking, having the thought, I'll move towards creation, is the astral level. As it puts that thought into motion to start creating, that's the energetic level. Then what is created is the physical or material plane. I'm just going to say that to you. So we all exist on an astral, an energetic, and a material level. We have to. So the chakras, which are vortices of energy within that astral spine, which is as real as our anatomic spine, but we can't see it. Medicine hasn't found a way to find it, but it's real. They are influenced by every single thing that we do in a lifetime. Every thought we have, every person we put ourselves in touch with, every musical note we hear, everything. Because thoughts, and again, you watch any of these movies now that are out that the physicists are doing, this is what quantum physics is. It says everything in the world is energy. And the common denominator of it all is the same. Just like whether you have ice or steam or water, H2O is the common denominator, right? Every single aspect of life comes from one form of energy. Some years ago, neutrino was the smallest form that had been discovered. Now they found out, wait a minute, that wasn't the smallest form. These are the physicists. But whatever it is, the physicists now know that that is what constitutes everything we see that we call life. And they will tell you, even our thoughts. A thought is energy as well, put into motion in that form as a thought. Everything's energy. So I heard a physicist say, physicist who was doing a study, you could watch this yourself, I talk about it all the time because it amazed me, but it's been a while now. So there's a documentary by a man whose name is Werner Herzog. He's very well known as one of the best documentarians that ever existed, and he's made many of them. But he made one called something like Encounters at the Edge of the World. And he went to Antarctica, where the scientists go, right, to the tune of billions of dollars every year, and they spend months there. It's not easy to get there, not easy to live there, doing experiments, the best scientists in the world. And he did a documentary there, that one. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful if you can get it and watch it too. And he was interviewing everybody throughout this documentary. The last one he interviews is a physicist. This documentary was made some years ago. Dr. So-and-so, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm trying to find a neutrino. So Werner says, okay, what is a neutrino? And the physicist says, that's just it. We don't know. We know, and he goes on just like this, and he's getting more and more excited. And he's, I tell you, eventually he actually starts to cry because he says, we know that these neutrinos make up every single thing we see that we call life, that every thought that I just had, billions of neutrinos were moving around, but we can't find it. He says, we're beginning to think they live in a universe all their own. Then he said, you know, Werner, we're beginning to think that this is God. It was so touching for the whole world to see, he says this, like this physicist who's one of the most well-known physicists in the world. So I'm not giving you some opinion of mine. I'm telling you, the physicists know energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can always be transformed, and every single thing is a matter of energy. Now, these masters have been saying that to us for thousands of years. This is what Jesus did. You know, the whole point of the story of Jesus is the resurrection. It's not the crucifixion, even though everybody gets stuck with the crucifixion. It's the resurrection. He's saying, like a human body, what's that? You worried about that human body? I'm not there. Look, here. And he goes in front of his people who are looking at him, touching him. He's as real as he was before. And he says, peace be with you. Yes, of course I'm here. That death didn't mean anything to me. It was just one body. You know, so if we realize that every single experience, not just that we have, but every thought that we think, when we think something negative about somebody or something positive, when we open our hearts with love, when we decide to get really selfish or mean or figure out how we're going to get somebody back or whatever it is, doesn't matter how justified it is, it leaves an imprint in our chakras somewhere. And that becomes the blueprint by which that jiva that I was talking about before manifests based on our lives experience. And it doesn't matter whether we're a very young soul and we're out there being part of the mafia and killing people, or whether a more highly evolved soul and we're here trying to figure out how can I die consciously and make it a meaningful experience. It doesn't matter. We're all just on this ever expanding continuum. And if you ask Yogananda, do you ever quit expanding? He said, no, you just expand till you're part of infinity. There's no end to this. No end. We just become a part of all that is. And I hope those words are making a little more sense now than they did 2 hours ago. We become part of a superconscious reality out of which everything in every galaxy has been made. And we don't know that. Because we don't know that doesn't mean it's not the truth. Wasn't that many years ago when people thought that Earth and its solar system was the only galaxy that existed? How many do we know about now? There's an article that I use. I don't have it now and I haven't looked at it in years, but I used to use for my talks, that the man under one of the presidents in the late 1800s who was in charge of the Patent Bureau, literally there's a letter from him to the president saying, we may as well close it. Everything that can ever be discovered has been now. You know, we don't know. We are so limited. So we have to just go on faith for a little while, which will allow us to start having the experiences that say, absolutely, there's really something to this. Because just moving along spiritually means thinking good thoughts, choosing our friends mindfully, deciding what we're going to do next Friday evening matters. Gee, there's a spiritual retreat. Should I go? Or do I want to lay in bed and watch television? What does it mean that people turn on their televisions in their bedrooms and watch everything that they watch? Even the advertisements. It's horrible. I can't believe people do it. I mean, and then everybody comes, and what's one of the most common complaints? In medicine, I can't sleep. Of course you can't sleep. Look at what you just did to yourself. You know, but seriously, people don't think. And even us, that's why I said before, I could tell anybody a lot of the ways that I don't live as purely in touch with what I'm saying as I could. I'm growing. You know, but every single time, every moment of our life is having an impact on these chakras. And if we know that, and we shouldn't drive ourselves crazy with it, but we live as consciously as we can, we make the most uplifting choices that we can, the most expansive choices that we can. You know, we sometimes do things that wind up hurting other people, but the intention is not about hurting anybody. I've had to end relationships in my life because I knew now they were just simply not good for me, but the other person didn't necessarily want to end them, and you can do that with as much love as you can muster. Somebody's going to get hurt, but we make sure our hearts are open as we're moving. Then we have to say, it's dharmic. It's what is good for the whole universe. There is a beautiful, beautiful stanza right near the end of the Bhagavad Gita. If I had that book, I would read it to you, that says, anything that you need to do that you feel, even like breaking a previous commitment, this is Krishna speaking, so he says it like way more beautifully than I'm saying it, but basically, he says, this is God speaking to Arjuna. This is like Jesus sitting there having dinner with the disciples, real life talk. He says, anything that you need to do that's going to take you closer to God, that's going to put you more in touch with me, more in tune with me, I will support you to do that, even if you have to tell certain friends you don't want to see them anymore. You know, even if you genuinely know that a relationship that you're in, genuinely, now this isn't in your mind, this isn't an excuse, this is meditate on it, this is find it in an intuitive level. Do I belong in this relationship or not? You know, even jobs that we take or keep. There are people who come to me year after year who are in caustic jobs. They're horrible for them. And I tell them, I know this is a hard decision. I've lived a lot of my life without any money. I know how scary that can be. But the sacrifice that you're making is huge, huge, bigger than we know, because everything is always leaving an imprint on our chakras. And not just in the conscious way, not just what we can see energetically. That's why sitting in a restaurant. You know how they make the music very loud and rambunctious because that draws most people. It does. It's on purpose. They crowd people close together. They play loud music and they're packed. Those are the restaurants that are packed. But do we want to be sitting in them? And I don't know for anybody else, but I mean it's a decision that we need to make because we're going to carry that with us. Nothing happens at the end of this life. Nothing. That jiva just keeps going, and everything that happened here matters. Every really wonderful, good, uplifting, dharmic thing that we've done, every moment in meditation, every effort, there's a line in one of Swami Kriyananda's songs. I mean, there's thousands of lines that I love, but there's one line that says, every effort we spend gives more life in the end, for our gladness in joy. Joy is joys ever new. Just saying, keep trying. It's the effort. It's the intention. God's watching our heart. He's not watching the outcome. He's watching the spiritual path. It's directional. It's not a point we get to. We could be hundreds of thousands of lives away from, although Yogananda says it's not true. Not true for those of us who are consciously seeking. He said you have to have very, very, very good karma. He said these words to one of the disciples, one of his monks, when he was alive, who came up and said, oh, Master, I don't think I have very good karma. And he looked at him very seriously. He said, don't ever say that. I mean, he was living with Yogananda. He said, you have to have very, very, very good karma to even want to know God. So it says a lot. You know, I'm not just speaking frivolously when I say, and I said this in the prayer class the other night, I said, and I mean it now too, it's an incredible statement that we're here. It means so much that you were drawn to be here and that you're here, or that I decided however many months ago to teach this class and that I'm here. It matters so much. It says so much about our karma, because our karma is reading, in essence, our chakras. The chakras are what our karma is. They're the chakras are the blueprint upon which we say, what's our karma? And we have karma. We have to live it out. It's going to happen. We think we're in charge of things. We think we're making decisions. We're making very few decisions that aren't. We can affect our karma. We can definitely affect it by making positive choices, by moving towards the light, I will say, by really consciously trying to bring energy up away from the material. That's what the chakras are. Ultimately seven chakras. Down here is the material plane. Up here is super consciousness, Christ consciousness. And every single thing we do that moves us in that way, it's neutralizing. They call it, and that's what Patanjali's first sutra is about. The very first thing Patanjali, who's the father of all yoga, not hatha yoga, but yoga, he said, the neutralization of the vrittis, or the whirlpools of energy, is what this spiritual path is about. So we're neutralizing those energies by making conscious, good choices in our life. Now, as long as we're doing that, as much as we can, but again, making it conscious, because, you know, I don't know about you, but I've had moments in my life. I remember many years ago, I moved to Baltimore in an effort to try and be closer to my husband. That was the failed experiment, but I tried it for a few years. And I was so miserable there. I was really miserable. I used to say to myself, this is what the phrase, a fish out of water, means. It means you die. You know, like that's what that phrase means. A fish cannot live out of water. And I just felt like I was dying there. I mean, one day I finally said to my husband, if I don't go back to California, I'm going to get some awful disease and die here. I can feel it, and it's very close, and I have to leave right away. I mean, I had developed what was the third largest practice in the country there, medical practice. I had 6,000 patients. It's huge. And I said, I'm giving you 6 months' notice, and I'm leaving. I really thought I would die, and I could have, because I was beginning to see that it was about an energy. It wasn't about how strong a person I was, how much willpower I had, how much I wanted things to be right. I needed to be where my whole environment was supporting me to move spiritually, not in this middle place between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. That was not where it was. I looked for all the years I was there trying to find a spiritual group, something. Finally, I found a therapist who was a disciple of Muktananda's. And I said to him, what do I have to pay you to be with you once a week and meditate? I meant it. I mean, it was just, I was going to die otherwise. And I became aware I had to come back here. But when I was there, it was amazing how easy it was to skip a meditation. It's impossible for me here, you know? Because we put ourselves in other environments, and then all of a sudden, there's a wonderful story let me not do the names because I might get them wrong, but some great avatar, not anybody we've known, but one of the great avatars, and he had his disciple with him, and the disciple was saying, I don't understand. How is it that people get so lost out there? How is it that it happens? And they feel like they know you, or they're starting to know you, and then they get so lost. And just then the teacher says to him, oh, Narda, I'm so thirsty. I see a village over there. Can you just run over and get me some water and come back? And then the story goes, Narda goes, and he knocks on the door for water, and there's this beautiful young woman who opens the door, and he falls instantly in love with her. So he starts looking for work to stay in the village, and then he marries her. And then they have three children, and he's working, and they've got a home. And the story goes on and on. And then comes these torrential rains and floods. And in the course of these floods, he loses one after another after another. And he's finally holding on at one point to one child by the hand and his wife, but the floodwaters just come and take them. And all of a sudden, he finds himself. He wakes up, and he's laying in a desert. And he thinks, what happened? And his teachers are saying, Narda, Narda, what happened to you? I sent you a little while ago for a glass of water, and you got lost. You know, like time is an illusion. Not much time had passed. But just to say, this is what happens. There's all these brightly colored things that they're dangling in front of you that they say are so wonderful. That was Dave or she saying to the baby, keep screaming. It takes a lot of effort to keep ourselves on this course. Now, anybody want to say anything or ask any questions? Or
to help with this, and then they can be the one to help execute it.
Yeah, well, you know, what you're saying, Ellen, is just a wonderful idea. Yes, I mean, we all definitely need help. And, you know, literally, this is a personal thing for me, but on my medical card, it says help with dying. I have been hired by many people to go to their homes and help them die. And, you know, and it's smart. I mean, it's really smart that people do that. And as ministers, we would always do that. Of course, you know, the difference between as a minister, how much can we be there, whatever. But I mean, and I don't feel badly about it. As a physician, I charge an hourly fee. And there are many people who have wanted me to talk to their families or describe what's going to go on or be there in those last days before they pass, and who are just willing to buy that, like what you said. People pay attorneys to write out wills or trusts or whatever because we don't know anything about it. But I agree with you. I think there can't be, because here's what I was going to say next that fits right into this. What happens when we die? What about those moments, whether they're weeks or days or, I mean, if they're months? If I were dying over months now, it happens to be my whole life that everybody in my world just about is a minister on this path, and I will get that kind of help. And I know you have been here a lot. I would say to you, it would be so important to get somebody to be coming at least weekly, to be a minister in the house or wherever you are, to help you remember what's important, because again, that's why the Narda story is so important. You know, when we did this death and dying class as a 4- and 8-week series, there was a woman in the class, I don't remember her name, but I certainly wouldn't say it anyway, who was sick. Something was going on with her, and I don't remember what it was. And she disappeared from class at some point, and I just never heard from her again. I tried to call her, I tried to email her, I think it was a cancer, and I think it must have come back. But it really, it was so painful for me. I mean, I remember having this experience of physical pain that she wasn't reaching out. We had developed a little bit of a relationship. It was the death and dying class, but maybe she had taken the chakra class before. I felt like I'd known her. Like, didn't she know that I could be with her and help her? Because I knew her whole story, and there was nobody there who could help. And it's not about a path. People, I'm not called professionally to people who are on this path. It's about the spirit of it all. And in fact, if you're open to the spirit of it all, the path doesn't matter at all, and the religion doesn't matter at all. I've helped so many people leave in hospitals and just so many different things. I remember years ago, because I was an ICU nurse for 14 years before I went back to medical school, and I was just very used to being in hospitals, and when I started in medical school, nobody was. They were terrified. Furthermore, they were these little 21-year-olds. I mean, they were babies, and they were in these really difficult situations, and very often my classmates would call me, Shanti, can you come? They'd get scared if somebody was having trouble breathing or was trying to pass and they couldn't. And I'd been in ICU and a CCU nurse. So I really knew more than most doctors know about being there with people when they were dying. But I remember so many times I would have to say to everybody in the room, could everybody step out for a few minutes? And then just to be with the person and either be touching them or speaking with them or just being with them in a way that says, it's all okay. Everything's okay here. And sometimes that was just a thought that was coming. It didn't matter what religion I was. I certainly didn't know about this path. I was just coming onto this path at that time. And the week I started medical school, I found Ananda. But anyway, I think, you know, well, we've talked a lot about doing a hospice program, but we don't have right now. We want to do that. So when it's time, it will manifest. Because there are a lot of people who would love to have it. But I would say to you, make it happen. These are these kinds of living wills that we need to write, you know. And it doesn't need to be me, but I mean, you could easily say, you know, call Shanti or call somebody. I want them to come. I want them to talk with you. Certainly if people know that they're getting ready to leave, having the person come. I remember there's a wonderful story, which anybody who's ever been in any class of mine has heard it, so bear with me. There was a woman who came to see me years ago. I was here in Palo Alto, but I had a traditional medical practice. Well, as traditional as my practices ever got. And she walked in, and the story goes just like this. All right, I want you to know. I went out and called her name in the waiting room. She comes in. She sits down. I didn't even sit down. I want you to know I'm here. I hate doctors. I've always hated doctors. I don't believe a word they say. And I haven't seen a doctor in 2 years. And the only reason I'm here, this is exactly how it went. This is not an exaggeration. Is because yesterday I saw a gynecologist, and she was spent 5 minutes with me and told me that I had an inoperable tumor and I was going to die. And I heard you're good and I want your opinion. Just like that. So I said to her, I listened to that, and I said, hi, I'm Shanti. I mean, I had to break that energy. Then I forget if it was an hour and a half or 2 hours with this woman, but that's what I used to do and when I was meeting somebody new. And in that period of time, I don't know how many times that woman told me how much she hated her husband. She's just said it over and over. I hate my husband. I hate him. I've been waiting for the right time to leave him. I can't. Now the kids are gone. I was just going to get ready to leave him. She was in her early 60s, and she was no more going to just leave him. She couldn't leave him. And now this. Wouldn't you know it, just this. This is how this woman was, too. I mean, I'm doing her very well. I was saying, like, okay, Divine Mother, I know you sent her to me for a reason, which was true. So I examine her, and sure enough, she's got this huge tumor inside of her. And I knew we probably weren't going to be able to treat that tumor, but I would never say that to somebody at a first visit, ever. I mean, I believed her when she told me this story about the gynecologist, and I was upset about it. But I said to her, look, so, you know, she gets dressed, we're sitting down. She said to me, I hate doctors so much, I've been bleeding for over a year, but I didn't want to go. So that's never quite a good sign either. So anyway, so we sit down. I said, look, you know, there's a sizable tumor in there, but let me get a look at it. Let's get a CAT scan. Let's get some blood work, all these things. And I said to her, let me see you back in 3 weeks. I'll have all the results then. You know, I can have the results tomorrow. But I didn't want to have the results tomorrow, nor did I think there was any rush. I said to her, before you go, I'd like to give you an assignment. She looks at me. I mean, she had barely softened. I was nice, really nice to her for 2 hours. Because, you know, it's easy to be nice when there's nothing at stake for me. I just kept caring about her and caring about her. I said, I want you to develop this practice of saying 3 nice things a day to your husband. She goes, oh, that's not going to be easy. I said, well, I didn't say it would be easy, but I think you ought to do it. Why are you giving me this assignment? I said, you know, I can tell you truthfully, it's just an intuition that I have, but also, I said, you know, I have a feeling it would be good for everybody for you to try and get a little more clear. You're carrying around a lot of negative energy about your husband. Because she was one of these people, like I've met 1,000 of, who think they know everything. They think they've been right-minded. They're taking all the right supplements. They've eaten the right food. They've taken a yoga class every week, and they look like her. You know, like nothing's gotten in. She said, well, what do you think I could say? I said, I don't know. I said, you know, you told me one of the reasons you're really mad at him is because he is never home. He works a lot. I said, why don't you do this? Every time he's in the house, go up to him, put your arms around him, and say to him, honey, I am so glad that you're here right now. She rolls her eyes in disgust. So I said to her, here's an idea. Why don't you become an actress? Act it. Just pretend that you're on stage and you're saying, honey, I'm so glad that you're here right now. Say it like you mean it. Well, what are the other 2 things? I said, I don't know, you come up with them. She grabs her papers, just like this, storms out, slams the door. So I go out and I say to the woman, a naturopath who I shared this apartment with, actually rented space from her, I said, boy, am I going to be shocked if that woman comes back. She's really seriously mad at me. So 3 weeks later, she comes back. She comes in and we sit down and we have this talk about her tumor, and I said, it's really big and here's what's happening. And I said, you know, we can't do surgery. We could try some chemotherapy. If you want to try and shrink it a little, we can maybe give you a little more time. I mean, it was a good talk, you know, for about close to an hour. And then I said to her, Mari, she was sort of winding up to leave. I said, how are things at home? She says to me, great, why? So I said to her, are you kidding me? I mean, just like that, I said, Mari, you were here 3 weeks ago, and all you could tell me is how much you hate your husband. She said to me, Dr. Rubenstone, you won't believe it. I said, yes, I will. She said, when I left here, I was so mad at you. I said, I know. She said, I didn't think I was coming back. I said, neither did I. I just kept in. She said, and I got in that car and I said, I'm going to do this just to prove her wrong. And she said, but within 3 days, our lives changed. Within 3 days. It's a powerful story for no matter what class it's about. The most powerful thing was they were one of these families who really invited me in. They, I mean, understandably, after it was like, it was a miracle. That's a miracle. That is a miracle. He put himself on a leave of absence from work. He never worked another day till about 2 months after she died. She died in about 4 months. The kids came down a lot. They had 2 kids. I mean, I was totally involved in that whole family and really helped them all as she left. It was a miracle. It was one of the most beautiful comings together of a family and of helping somebody die. And you know, it matters so much where we are when we leave, at the moment that we leave. It really has everything to do. Now, this I don't know. This I'm telling you from what many people who do know have told me. I mean, many great teachers. Of, you know, there's so many places our soul can go. They're called lokas. I mean, there's so many levels, places, different areas, depending on what's to happen next. It's not like there's just heaven or hell. But, and how, where we are, literally as our soul leaves, really matters. But if we practice all the time, getting our soul there is very different. Now, most of us are not going to be Mahatma Gandhis, that somebody comes up, puts a gun right to your chest and shoots you, and you're just calling to God. Jai Ram, Jai Ram, you know, victory. Those are the words as he's dying. Most of us wouldn't do that. We'd be screaming. We'd be terrified, you know? So more and more and more practice. I say to myself a lot, if anything happens, if there's an earthquake, remember to call God. If you're in a car accident, I tell myself, remember, call God. If I just practice as much as I can, because I know what my instinct would be. It would be to scream and get scared, you know, if I'm on the second floor of my house and a big earthquake hits, or, you know, we have to be as ready as we can be, practicing as much, because it really matters. How the soul leaves really matters. But here's another thing that I do want to share with everybody. When I moved up here to go to medical school, almost the last words I heard from anybody in San Diego, this man walked up to me in a bookstore. My husband and I were there. He said, hey, heard you saying that you're moving up to Palo Alto. When you get there, just like this, go to East West Bookstore. First thing you do, you get it? Go to East West Bookstore. Okay. A total stranger. That was it. And he walked away. And we landed and we went to East West Bookstore. Literally, if not that day, it was the next. And East West Bookstore, as you may know, or not know, is owned by Ananda. And at that time, it was in Menlo Park. It was a charming little store. And the first book I bought there the day I went, and there's much more to this story, but it's not important to this class, about I was just drawn right into Ananda by the people who met me. And, I mean, that's another one of those ways that Yogananda in San Diego, where we lived, right next to Encinitas, which is where he landed when he came to California, just sends this stranger up to me and sends me to Ananda. I mean, it's just so amazing. But anyway, I bought this book, and I don't remember the name of it now. I wish I did. It's been out of print for years, though. And it's a book about a barrister in England who didn't believe in God, didn't believe in anything. And he was away on a summer vacation at the beach in England with his wife and his son's wife and their two little kids. And they're on their way home, and the son and his family is in the car in front of him, and they have a head-on collision, and they're all killed instantly in front of this lawyer, the father, who doesn't believe in anything. It was devastating. I mean, he wrote this book. The barrister wrote this book. 6 months later, there's a knock at his door. And the woman said, you know, are you the father of whatever? And Mintz again, she said, well, I have a message. And he said, I'm sorry, but my son died 6 months ago. And she said, I know, I have a message. And he just became enraged with her. And he threw her out, but she left her card outside, which he picked up and called her sometime later. And the whole book is about what happened. But the reason I'm telling this story now is because the son said to him, Dad, I want you to know, I never felt a thing. We never suffered. I felt instantly free. I watched the accident happen. That's what he said. So this is getting back to part of, are people really suffering when they die? I mean, again, I could just sit here and just tell stories the whole rest of the time about experiences I've had with this. And in fact, I do want to share one more story with you before we end. But they're not going through what we're going through, what we're seeing. It's not what it looks like. Very often, that jiva knows, because they're operating at an energetic and astral level too. They know when something's coming or what's going to go on, and they're out of there. They're not hooked on the physical body. It was a vehicle. It was an instrument to use. That's really what it is. Yogananda, there's a quote here that I would love to read to you about this, because it really matters about the actual dying and what it's like, and again, why, what it's like, and why it is really important to, if it matters to you, I mean, if you're going to make it important, to make sure there are people in your life who can help with this, just like what you're saying. Ellen, and I'm in the same situation that you are. My family is not the family that could do this. Some of the people, now, I've lived in this community for over 16 years. I've been involved in it for way more than that, so my life is so much Ananda. But there's, I still have a lot of family and friends from before who would feel entitled to be there, and in ways. And that's complicated. Yogananda said, yoga is a science by which the soul gains mastery over the instruments of body and mind and uses them to obtain self-realization. Self-realization being the reawakened consciousness of its transcendent, its, meaning the soul's, transcendent, immortal nature, one with spirit. Gains mastery over the instruments of body and mind. Now, if we happen to be helping it, that's wonderful. But I'm just going to share one more story with you. Again, all by way of saying death is not what it looks like. When I was a nurse many years ago, when I worked in the ICU, I was in my early 20s. And I was the head nurse of an intensive care unit in Washington, D.C. And so I was sort of, you know, well-respected by the doctors, and many of them were residents, and I knew more than they did because I was there all the time. And they knew they were coming through on a 1 or 2 month rotation. One night, this man who had been in our unit had a cardiac arrest, and so we started resuscitating him. He was a relatively young guy, but at some point about 45 minutes into it, the doctors wanted to call the arrest, just stop it, because his pupils were fixed and dilated, which means somebody's brain dead. But I just kept having this feeling of saying, I don't want us to stop it. We should not stop it, you know. And at some point, and they just were both respectful enough and I think frightened enough to listen to me. So we kept doing this. It's not an easy thing. You're pushing adrenaline into the heart, literally. You're these long needles, putting it right in. You're doing CPR. You're breathing for them. Now he's intubated and on a respirator. It's a big deal. At some point, I look up into that, and I'm looking because the bed was this way, and he was up in that corner, and I see the guy who's in this bed. But he's up there, real as anything. This is a little ICU room. I mean, it's not. And I look at him, and he looks at me, and he gives me a big wink with his right eye. This is a true story. So I said to these docs, we are not stopping this resuscitation. Anyway, a little bit later, he comes back. His heart starts. He starts breathing. So the next night, I came into work, and he's still on the intubated on the respirator, but I take his hand. I said to him, hey, how you doing? He squeezes my hand. I said, I know that tube's of pain, but you're doing okay? He goes, yeah. And I said, great. I said, it's so good to see you. And he gives me that same big wink with his right eye. And I remember that night, I mean, I was young. I called my mother. I was in D.C. She was in Pittsburgh. I said to her, you know, I feel like this little peon from Pittsburgh. That's what I said to her. I said, but Mom, we have no idea. We don't know one thing. You have to realize this is 45 years ago. You know, I mean, nobody was talking about this stuff. Nobody. There was nothing or stories written about near-death experiences. Nobody, it just wasn't out there. I mean, I helped at that time open the first coronary care unit in the whole world. You know, everything was so new. Hospice wasn't even developed yet. People weren't talking about death and dying. In that moment, I knew there was so much more than what I know. And that these souls, it's not, there's no suffering over there. But that how we leave matters. And then there's all this karma. His karma was to have me there. And my karma was to be there. To have this profound experience that probably changed the whole rest of my life. You know, I mean, one of many experiences, but anyway, very amazing to get. And again, this could go on for hours. Death is not what we think it is. It's a beautiful part of our journey. You know, it's the most important moment in life. I'm going to tell you before you go about an essay that Swami Kriyananda has written. In fact, I meant a copy of it. And if anybody wants copies, we'll go over there a few minutes early and I'll make a lot of copies for you. It's called The Final Exam, Death Being the Final Exam. But he gives a lot of suggestions about what to do to get ready for death. I mean, things like what we're talking about, but about how to keep your mind cleansed and this and that. I mean, mostly, I've spoken about it in very different terms than that essay does, but it's the same kind of stuff. Living consciously, making conscious choices, respecting the fact that whether you've been aware of it or not, that you are first and foremost a spiritual being. And it's at that level that we need to take care of ourselves and that we are constantly being influenced at all levels, even on an astral level, by everything that happens to us in life, every choice we make. You know, so I used to have this thing. I thought I would be smart. I'd look at some guy walking down the street in plaid pants and yellow socks and a striped shirt. And I would do this thing in my mind all the time. Like, oh, man, what happened this morning? Like, did he get up and put on those clothes? And he looked at himself in the mirror and said, now this is a great outfit. And I'd make fun of the person. Or watch somebody who was significantly overweight eating a banana split in those days. All the time, all these things that I used to do. And I think to myself, for many years now, I've thought, oh my God, we need to be sending love to everybody. We need to see God looking back out at us through the eyes of everyone that we see all the time, because that's the truth. And we need to be nourishing and nurturing their divine essence. Because really, loving them is loving ourselves, because we're all a part of the same reality. That, by the way, is the topic of the sermon for tomorrow, so my talk just came to me. But it really is. I mean, as we get closer and closer to realizing we are not separate beings, like that physicist was saying, there's nothing that keeps keeping us separate, except what Einstein said. Einstein said the illusion that we are separated from anything is an optical delusion of our consciousness. Those were his words, because he knew intuitively, the way Einstein knew everything, that we're all a part of exactly the same force. Brahms knew it too. You should read that book, Conversations with Great Composers, and Beethoven. And all, so many of these great souls who have had an experience where they've communed with the divine. Once it's happened to you, it's an undeniable truth. Until it's happened to you, it's just somebody else's words. This is where meditation comes in. This is why meditating is so important, because ultimately it's the only way to get there. It is the peace that links us and that takes us up the spine and connects us with the divine. I just want to say one thing. Are you at all inclined, Linda, to share your story right now? I mean, I'm going to ask you to... Why don't we change places? Come on over here. I'm just going to put this on you. So as you speak.
So this happened in the late 90s. I had been very sick for 3 years, getting worse and worse and worse. And I was so sick, my hair started falling out, and I could barely be on my feet. And I knew that I didn't want to die, but I needed the suffering to stop. And one night, when I fell asleep, I dreamed that my parents were in front of me in the house. It was a two-story house. We never lived in a two-story house. My parents didn't look anything like my parents really look, but there were two people that were them. And we were in the front area of the house. And I have many siblings, and none of them were there, so there's all these incongruities. But I was floating in the air in front of them, and my body was wavy, and you could see straight through it. And we were telling each other goodbye, but we just used our minds. We didn't say any words. And we said our goodbyes and we came to closure. And then I floated away from them through the ceiling and through the roof, and was in white light. And it was wonderful. It was so pleasurable. I felt two overwhelming feelings. The first one was complete and total relief, just the relief you can't describe. Just there's no words. It was profound and wonderful. And then the second feeling was unconditional acceptance of every essence of my being, which was just the sweetest thing. You can't describe how it was just so wonderful. I was really, really happy. It was fabulous. And then I woke up. So I wasn't given a choice. I didn't see my life go past me or anything, but it was such a profound experience, and I think it happened because I was so far gone physically that it was the universe saying, hey, we're going to give you this really nice experience so you can get more energy and keep going. And I ultimately recovered. It was gluten intolerance. No one knew it back then. but that was my experience, and I think it was just another step of getting further onto a spiritual track.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, I really appreciate it, because it's just so affirming of everything that I've been sharing. And as I said early on, it takes it away from anything personal, but it's out there. I think when we're given those experiences, it is absolutely Divine Mother saying to us, don't worry, I'm here. And look at what this total freedom from the constriction, the confinement of this human experience is. Look at it. And it just allows us to continue. It gives us hope that we can be free again. That's such a beautiful, beautiful story. I could feel the lightness of being and the freedom. Wow. And it sure does get you onto a spiritual path, just like a diagnosis of CLL can. I mean, you know, we get motivated in ways, but very wonderful. Did you want to ask another question?
I have a question that, I guess one of my concerns is that I'd be allowed to die after my body is physically dead.
Yeah.
That I don't know how long it takes for the soul to leave the body, and I don't want that process interrupted.
Yes.
And so I've been trying to, as I've taken notes, what I've tried to do is define that there should be a three-day period.
Yeah.
But I don't know, can you speak to how long it takes or what?
You know, I've read something about this, but I'm blocking on it right now exactly how much time. But it is a couple days, depending on the circumstance. Now, you heard me tell that story where that young boy said, I was out of that body before the impact of the cars.
Yes, I can see an accident forces it or something.
Yeah.
See,
we just don't know, because other times I've definitely read by sources that I would believe that when it happens suddenly, sometimes the soul gets very confused and grabs onto the body. So I don't think it's an always thing. But again, we don't know how we're going to go, but I always imagine myself going. Since I was a very little girl, when I was 4 years old, I used to tell people I wanted to die from cancer. It's sort of interesting because I wanted to, because I wanted time. I didn't want to precipitously leave. That was... that I hoped that I would die in a way that I was given. Why would a little four-year-old be saying those things? I don't know. Some memory from some past life, probably. But there is a period of, I think, a couple of days where they say the soul, for the soul to leave. And, you know, Yogananda and Kriyananda, and this I did just read somewhere. I don't think it's in this essay, but that maybe yesterday I was reading something or, I mean, in preparation for this class, but... that he said, it takes a while for the energy to really leave your whole body, and they both speak against donating organs, interestingly, because I was always for it, and then a number of years ago somebody told me that, and I looked it up, but it also just made sense to me, and I changed my driver's license and all that for that reason, that it's not just an instantaneous thing, okay, they're dead. You can watch the energy leave a body. It literally leaves up the chakras. And you can just watch that happen if you've watched anybody die. I know when my husband died, it was a very hard death. That soul did not want to leave that body. He, of course, that's who he was in life anyway, but he struggled. Oh, my God. That guy, it was a really difficult death to be there. Actually, I can... smile about it now, but it was a very painful night. But I did not feel, when they came to take his body, I wanted the body to stay for a while, because I just didn't feel that he was gone yet. I just had that feeling, you know, whereas other times I've been there, my mother died, she was out of there. You know, just very different. My sister, who had been doing that transitioning, because she and I had been doing it together, when she actually quit breathing, I felt okay about leaving her. But I can find that out for you, actually, what Yogananda said about it.
Yeah, I'd be very interested.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's the source, I believe, anything he said.
Sure.
I'll find out, and I'll get, might take me some days, but I'll get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But you're right, that is another wise thing.
Yeah, but I think it's a difficult thing to set up, because you don't know where you're going to be when it happens, and
yeah.
You just can't tell somebody,
I know.
Yeah, leave me there for 3 days.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, they could move your body. I mean,
yes.
The question is, you know, should they... I read an interesting thing this morning. Maybe it's in this essay that, you know, somebody asked Swami Kriyananda the question about cremation versus burial.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, as a rule, cremation's better. But he gave a couple of examples where people had died, but the souls weren't done yet. And he said that Robert E. Lee's mother died at a young age, and she was buried, but she was in her casket, but not buried yet. And she regained consciousness. And she was banging on her coffin, and somebody was there, and she got out, and it was after that that she had Robert E. Lee. Isn't that? I just read that story. That's an amazing story. Well, you know, because I remember in one of the classes that I've given, Connie Hernandez, who's a naturopath, was telling a story. And I remember this struck me as being very odd, because she said the family didn't want anybody but her around. This was over in Hawaii. They were a Japanese family. And mm-hmm. Connie had lived in Japan. They had known this family for a long time. And Connie said, so there I was. And she said, I had never been called upon to pronounce anybody dead. And I thought, God, I've done that so many times, like decided somebody's dead. And that, I mean, I have. It's just, but this morning I thought, whoa, okay, I'm going to take an extra 5 minutes from now on. But even with my husband, when he was dying, so my first husband who died, but we had been separated. He was remarried. I was very, very close with him and his wife, very close with him. I mean, there was such a thing as soulmates, and she knew that. I mean, so all three of us. She's actually that woman who's sick right now, and it was beautiful when he was dying. I mean, I was with them. And he would stop breathing sometimes for 5-6 minutes. He did it about 3 times. And I just felt so grateful that I didn't, because I would say, okay, it looks like this is the moment. You know, because you have to put a time of death on, who cares about all that anyway, but, and then 5 minutes later, he'd start breathing again. And I remember saying to her a couple of times, he's just not ready to go. He does not want to go. Anyway, this is all, you know, and everybody sort of does it in their own way, but there is an answer to how long the soul stays. Yeah,
might have
come from that.
Nobody remembers it anymore.
Yeah. And you know, Jewish people don't believe in embalming the body, so they do not embalm at all. So those funerals happen sooner, but still, you know, can be 36 hours that the body will be there to be viewed.
And
so
I think the example of Jesus' death and resurrection is actually the soul leaving you doing that. So
oh, yeah.
There is 3 days.
3 days. Yeah. Well, you're right.
Like
it's spoken
where.
To...
So
yeah.
That's why I think it's 3 days.
You know, it might be. Not that Jesus could, you know, appear before us right this moment if he chose to, but I think still, since everything about his life was a lesson, I don't know. I'm going to look it up, and I'll ask Gosh if she may well remember just what that time is. But I'm also interested. We're also into that Easter story because, of course, it just happened, and it's so magnificent. But I'm wondering about, is there that connection of those 3 days?
Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much. This has been a wonderful, that makes me wonder if we should do part one and part two. There was so much more that I wanted to talk about. No, you always think, well, you just say whatever you can say, which is, of course, what we did. But it's such an interesting and fascinating topic, really. So. Know about how it's